Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello, and welcome to the Create More podcast, episode number 2, with me, Ben Stewart. That's it, this is a thing now. We've done the first one last week with Assemble Studios, and this week, or this fortnight, I should say, I'm with the very interesting and very lovely David Batchelor, who is a very well-known artist from London. I guess you could call him a colour or light artist. I think that's doing a bit of an injustice to him. He's done a lot more than that, which we go over about an hour talking all about kind of what he's been into and really interesting. I got to go over to his gallery or his studio space over in Bow, and we got to talk about his current art and what's up in exhibitions, and we went right back to the very beginning of how he became an artist and the struggles of being an artist in Birmingham, I guess you could say. If you're tuning into this, thank you. If this is your second time, I hope you enjoyed the Assemble Studios project, this podcast, sorry. And if you didn't listen to last week's podcast, then go back on iTunes or Acast and check it out, because I think it's really good. And it's been really well received. I heard lots of nice things about it, actually, which is very encouraging. And right, what else do I need to say? That's it. If you're listening to this through iTunes, which is fantastic that you found us through iTunes, can I just ask you to stop listening to iTunes, go on your iPhone or iPad or on a web browser and go to acast.com or Acast if you're Northern, which I get accused of a lot. Why should you listen through iCast and not iTunes? Well, if you've got the time and the patience, if you listen through Acast, I go to a lot of effort to embed images and links for websites and stuff. So a lot of these podcasts are very visual based. And the great thing about using Acast is every time I talk about something, if you're listening on your phone or on the web browser, an image pops up to kind of curate the podcast in a really good way. And if there's any links or any talks or videos that I found really interesting, it's all embedded in the podcast. You don't have to do anything. You can literally just click on your home screen. You don't need to go to YouTube or anything. It all does it automatically through the thing. And you can share it. And I just think genuinely it makes the whole podcast more interesting. And I absolutely love it. And now my favorite podcast, obviously, the Scroobius Pit one that I talked about last podcast, he uses it loads. And it genuinely really enriches the podcast. So yeah, if you're listening to it on iTunes, just stop and listen to it through Acast. And if you don't, you know, well, I've tried. I can't do much more than that. Anyway, so let's get into the podcast. It's about an hour, and I think it's really, really interesting. And he was incredibly patient with me, and some of my more naive questions as a non-artist. He was really, really nice about, and just really informative, and it was so interesting to find out more about him. So I hope you enjoy it, and listen to the end to find out what's on next week's podcast. Yeah, that's it. We've started. So I don't have an introduction. I find it easier because I always find the beginning awkward. So I think it's better if we just start. So I'm here with David Batchelor. Thank you very much. We're at your new studio.
Yeah.
Where your old studio wasn't that far away, at Near Assemble Studios, who we interviewed last week.
I mean, the thing with studios is you usually have a short lease, a five-year lease, so you never know whether you're going to stay anywhere for very long. For the last 4 years, I had a studio on Hackney Road. Before that, I had a studio near Assemble in Bow, and now I'm back in Bow, but at a different bit.
Yeah, I've just built myself a studio upstairs in my house. I call it the Man Cave. Mm. And coming into the studio here, I'm very envious. It's significantly larger. It's very nice and clean.
It's new. You have to, every time you move studio, you have to compensate yourself for the move, so you have to add a bit more space.
And it's... because it's so wide, you've got all your art everywhere as well, which which looks amazing. Do you get the art back once you put it in a gallery? I mean, I guess the whole idea is you sell it, but...
Well, it depends. If you're exhibiting in a commercial gallery where the job is to, you know, for them and for you to get the work sold, then you kind of hope you don't get it back. And if you do get it back, then there's a problem.
So are the works on the wall ones that haven't sold or ones that you've actively wanted?
It's a combination. I mean, the other type of show, if you do a museum show, the work is not for sale and it's there to simply to, you know, present your work and hopefully, you know, have some sort of knock-on effect down the line somewhere. So that work you would expect to come back. But you don't want all the work to come back all the time because you end up with a studio full of work and nowhere, you know, and you do see studios which are kind of crammed with unsold work.
Well, how long have you been in this studio for now?
Oh, a month.
A month. I mean, it's not full, but, you know, I can see how very quickly a few test pieces, a few trial runs on some of the bigger pieces.
It's easy to fill a space, and I tend to like to have a lot of work around when I'm working, because I tend to have about, you know, maybe I've got four or five different projects on the go at the same time, and I just don't have the patience to concentrate on one thing until it's finished. I tend to move between them. So I just like to have stuff around to remind me of what I'm doing, essentially.
But it's amazing. I mean, I guess as well, a lot of my questions are going to be based on the process of being an artist. And one of the things that I was really interested in, I was listening to a talk you did in Sydney.
Bloody hell, yeah.
Oh, I've done my research. And one of the things you spoke about was your favourite bits of work were the accidental parts. And you called it like the process. And you actually... sometimes when you started out you had a clear idea of what you wanted in your head, for whatever reason that track changed and you were much happier with the end result.
I was talking with a poet a while ago who said the way a poem for him often started was and I think this is true probably more generally for poets, is that you have an image which converts to a line. And you really like that line. It really works for you. And so you'd try to build a poem around it. But in more cases than not, in order to finish the poem, you have to get rid of that line. Because it's the bit you're too conscious of in a way and you're too precious about or something like that. And the poem only becomes its own thing and it only becomes complete once that sort of initial trigger is chucked out.
Yeah.
And I think the process of making work, at least for me, if not for everyone else, is rather similar insofar as, you know, I don't really work with, well, you know, you'll have an idea, you'll see something in the street or even in the studio, or someone will mention something or see another piece of work and you think, maybe if, and that's about as formed as the quote unquote idea is.
Yeah.
And you take this, maybe if I do this to this and that, you take it to the studio the next day and it doesn't work, generally. It just, the minute you try to make it real, physically, it just collapses in a heap. But in the process, if you're lucky, something else happens that makes you think, oh, well, okay, I can't, maybe not that, but, and that next stage is the stage you hadn't anticipated. And in a way, it's the stage which is slightly beyond your imagination. Mm. And that's usually the bit that actually generates the new work and keeps you interested. So it almost always involves shedding the original notion.
It's such a hard thing to convey to someone who wants you to do something on a certain time scale and you're like, yeah, okay, but I need to find the thing that allows me to get to that stage. And it's not a line. It's a journey, and it's very difficult to speed that process up.
Yeah.
To put you under pressure, like the second pressure is involved, or do you like working to a deadline, or what's the process for you in that regard?
I don't mind working to a deadline, but at the same time, I don't like being under that much. The problem, if you didn't have deadlines, nothing would ever be made.
That's so true. Yeah.
And I write as well, and no single piece of writing would exist if it wasn't for a deadline. is my firm opinion. So in a way, a deadline can be useful because it can push you and stretch you a bit. And sometimes the constraints that are imposed, if someone's asking you to, if you're doing a commission of some sort, the constraints that are imposed by that brief, which are not of your making at all, and not things you generally want. Nevertheless, they can actually be useful in squeezing, something out that wouldn't otherwise have come out. So, and sometimes they just prevent you making anything any good. I mean, it doesn't always work. It's not a sort of jeweled universe where everything sort of twinkles in the end. Yeah. Sometimes they don't.
And you've got, I guess a lot of this stuff, it's like ideas that have kind of gone through to a certain point. You've parked that for a while, and then it's just simmering away. And maybe at 1 o'clock in the morning, on a random couple of weeks later, you go, I've got it. There, that's what I want to do. Or
not quite. Things are slower than that. You don't get quite the eureka moments. they're sort of slow mo eurekas, if they're any at all. Mm. I mean, what I've got, I've got a series of paintings in the studio, which are a series I've been working on for about 3 years now, which I'm still continuing, and they're evolving into slightly different things from how they began. Not least because the paint technology is changing, and paint does different stuff now than it did even 2 years ago. Some paints, at least. I've got a series of drawings which are ongoing. I'm always making drawings, and most things go back to drawing.
This is the as I said, I've got I'm using this on Acast, so. It helps a lot. I go back and re-listen to this once we've done it, and then every time you mention a painting or any one of these things, I then embed an image and it pops up on the phone as you're listening to it. So I was just going to take a photo, because these are a book that you've painted over. Is there a relevance? This is a series called October,
yes.
The book, but why don't you explain a bit?
Okay. Well, just before I do, I wanted just to kind of give you the kind of to make a sketch of the studio. Okay, I've got the bundle of paintings which are ongoing, the drawings that I'm working on or reworking, sculptures that I've either made and are just sitting here, or that are ongoing projects like this commission through which we met. So that and then just stuff. So there's always and there's photographs and so forth.
Well, what's interesting, I had like a pack of things I wanted to chat to you about, and images of works that I really, really liked, and I've come in here and kind of seen 90% of them around, so it'll be easy for me to jog my memory. But yeah, why don't you?
Okay, so these drawings, actually, unlike most of the work, and contrary to what I was saying earlier, actually do come from having an idea.
There you go. You see.
There was a magazine, a journal, which is still being published, which was first launched in 1975, called October. Mm. And anyone who's been to art school, studying fine art or art history. Or curating, say, would know October, because they will have had to read texts by one of their main writers. And October's been a very important part of sort of art history, and it's reshaped how art's written about. And it's hugely influential and very important, and North American. Hmm. However, since it was first published in 1975, or 76 actually, there's not been a single image ever in colour. So it's been very text-based, and its original editorial announced that it would privilege text over image. So it was theory rather than visual.
I won't lie to you, that sounds like a tough read.
Mm. Oh, I mean, some of it has its moments, but it can be kind of laborious in its. It is quite academic, and although the original writers, I think, are all of them very good writers, it also generates a sort of generations of impersonators who are less good. Anyway, so October's never done anything in colour. None of their magazines, none of their books have. And I just thought, well, I need to get my revenge on October magazine, given that my work for the last 20 odd years has been in colour. So I thought, I know what I'm going to do. And I had a copy of October number one since I was a student. Largely unread, it must be said, but which was always increasing in value because and I thought, I know, I'm going to colour in October magazine. I'm going to call it the October Colouring In book, and that's exactly what I did. But the idea was lurking around for a while, and it was only when I came to do an exhibition in the Fruit Market Gallery in Edinburgh a couple of years ago, and we had a room which I didn't know how to fill. And it felt like it'd be nice. I just had to put some new work in this room. I thought, oh, I know, I'll do it. I'll colour in October magazine, which I did.
So this is almost like a protest piece of work. So this is your.
it's a wry response.
But they evoke a lot of the. I can see a lot of your work, the shapes and patterns that you've used from other projects and stuff. And
Yeah, I mean, weirdly, it was quite hard to do, because not least because if you get it wrong, you can't redo it, especially the cover. You've only get one chance at the cover.
And
you know, this magazine is the original, you know, October number one from 76 is worth quite a lot of money now. So you don't, you know, there are not many copies around, so you can't mess it up. So it took me a long time to get started. And of course, I made lots of photocopies and I worked on the photocopies until I was you know, confident about it. And then I just went to the magazine itself. But I found it enormously enjoyable, oddly. and I just worked on it, you know, from page to page, and certain kind of, certain motifs started coming through. And basically it's all, you know, felt pens and, you know, black marker pens. And then the things that come to there, there's angles, triangles and circles and rectangles of one kind or another, and black and colour. And that's about it.
Cause this, I guess what I wanted to kind of talk about as well was, I find colour incredibly engaging. I love the colours that you use, and that's why, going back a bit, you know, this is why we worked together, was the work that you're working with British Land and Five Broadgate, which is the chroma rotation.
I've changed its name. I'm going to call it Chromorama now.
Chromorama.
It just sounds sort of cheesier.
Okay. And on that, I had to do the design and access statement. And
lucky you.
Yeah, I know. It was so the first draft was a little dry, I won't lie to you. And the planning department came back, and the planning consultant came back and said, I think you need to spruce it up a bit. And they just gave me free rein. So I went back to full uni presentation, and I just went through all of your back catalogue of, like, they wanted some really nice big colourful images to try and sell it to the planners. So I got to just go through your entire back catalogue, and then I sent it in, and they loved it. It looked more like a magazine article than anything that they've done. So a lot of the colours that you use I really like, but I don't know why I like them. And I was listening to your talk, and I hadn't realised that you originally had never actually started with colour.
Yeah.
It was almost a reaction to just what was around you at the time. And I guess I wanted to chat a bit about the beginning, because your original works were kind of, I don't know how to describe them, without
not very good, rather bad,
but they were
desperate.
If I say they were white,
some of them were white, some of them were black,
and they were a harder sell, I would imagine.
Well, not, and in a way not, because when I went to art college in the second half of the 70s, I was taught by conceptual artists, and you know, conceptual art was, you know, the most interesting thing around at the time by quite a long way, and you know, colour for a conceptual art is kind of kryptonite, and they wouldn't touch it.
Yeah, that's why I couldn't get my head around that. I guess I'm just the idea that you, oh no, we don't touch colour. That's not something that we do back in the.
That was how art was for a time, and you know, it's actually in some sense parallels what I was describing about October magazine, which came along. You know, conceptual art is really from mid-60s to, say, to mid-70s, and you know, the theoretical magazine comes along slightly later. Nevertheless, it was a scene at the time as a kind of reaction against what generally gets termed as high modernism, which was big colour field painting, which was seen, wrongly probably, as kind of as visually rich but sort of intellectually empty. I'm fundamentally think that's a wrong conception about it. And so I think a lot of these artists and theorists said, you know, well, you know, colour is a sort of, you know, it's a part of high modernism. If we're going to chuck out high modernism, you know, the colour's going to go with it. I think it's a misconception, because on the other hand, you know, the other work that was around at that time, say in the early 60s, was pop art and minimalism, both of which were very vividly coloured, often, not always. But they were nothing to do with the high modernism that everyone wanted to kind of kill.
Yeah.
So it's simply not true that colour was identified purely with this sort of out-of-date high modernism. So there's all sorts of problems, you know, within that conception and so forth. But nevertheless, I think any, you know, artists who tend to want to privilege, you know, ideas or political content over, you know, sensuous enjoyment, probably the first thing that's going to go is the colour.
Yeah.
Yeah, black and white signifies seriousness.
Yeah.
It in many ways.
Oh, a classic architecture thing is that, you know, if you don't want to be taken seriously, then you make your building out of very, very bright colours. I mean, that's not to say that they can't be used, but I understand that that's kind of how it's seen. You wouldn't do it's very hard to do a modern take, a serious high-end take on colour. I mean, there are architects that can do it.
But they tend to be few and far between.
Yeah.
So in the early 90s, I sort of stumbled out of the back of art college like everyone did.
Wait, this was in Birmingham or Nottingham?
I went to art school in Nottingham, did fine art there, and then I did cultural studies with Stuart Hall in Birmingham, not because I had a brilliant strategy or plan, but because I couldn't find anywhere else to go at the time. I got lucky. I mean, it actually turned out to be a phenomenal place to have been to, but it had nothing to do with art. And at the time, I thought I was done with art. Art school put me off art, big time.
It'll do that, right?
doing cultural studies in a university in Birmingham sort of got me back into it.
So you went to... What did you study in Nottingham then?
Fine art.
Fine art. And then you came to Birmingham and just changed tack completely.
I did cultural theory. You know, that, in a way, that's what I was... That's, you know, in a way, what people were... We were talking more about politics and culture when we were at college and thinking about it and reading about it. We were reading Western Marxism mainly, rather than, you know, art history or anything. So, you know, for quite a few people, you know, students of my generation, we tilted towards politics and culture more generally rather than art specifically. And some people stayed in that area. And for me, once I got out of art and out of art school, I felt very strongly that there was something missing, which drew me back to, you know, to making things, to drawing and to begin with. So,
what was Birmingham like at that time for art in general? I mean,
terrible.
Well, that's what I thought. So, I mean, because the reason I thought it was funny when I was reading about you was I went to Nottingham, and also I worked in Birmingham for a year. So, I love both these cities, but not for the art and the culture. They were just great cities to be like a young person, a student.
Absolutely.
But I was one of the questions originally was some of your earlier works. I was imagining in Birmingham would have. Did you even do your work in Birmingham?
No. I didn't make any work in Birmingham. I didn't make any art when I was at art school. You know, we wrote and did little journals and polemical, you know, texts and such like. And
so this was all very internal work then. This wasn't seen outside of your kind of.
No, I mean. I mean, the world was very different then, and the art world was very different indeed. Yeah. And there was no market. There was no opportunity to leave college and make a living as an artist. To pretend to make a living as an artist, you couldn't. Yeah, you know, it didn't make any sense. You know, you'd leave college and you'd sign on, or you'd go and do teacher training, which was a kind of death wish. although, you know, a lot of people did it, or you would, you know, find some sort of part-time work which would enable you, you would hope, somehow to, you know, continue some sense of a practice. You wouldn't expect to make, even, you know, the most successful artists at the time, a lot of them weren't making a living, they were teaching, they had to. There was no market. That changed, obviously.
Yeah.
So when I was at college, I never expected to make any art, and certainly not to sell any. When I went to Birmingham for a couple of years, you know, I thought I was over art entirely. So, you know, that there was a rather long sort of period of having to sort of when I finished Birmingham, I kind of ended up back in Nottingham and then in London, and I slowly began to build up some semblance of a practice again.
So was the draw to London? So you came fresh from Birmingham to London, and then
not quite, but I mean, to cut a long story short, I finished Birmingham in 1980 and I was in London by 84. I'd begun part-time teaching in and around Nottingham again, as a way of just generating a little bit of money, and rather than signing on in the end. And it was when I got to London, I began to imagine I might be making work. So I got a room in the flat in King's Cross I lived in. I also began to write reviews for a contemporary art magazine at the time called Art Scribe, which no longer exists. And that was it. It was hand-to-mouth stuff, but it was for most people. And the work I began to make, when I began to make work again, was black or white or grey, because not because I made a decision about that, but because that's sort of what work seemed to be at the time.
If you were reviewing art in the yeah. magazine stuff, you were very conscious of what art was not acceptable, but you know what got good reviews, and did you respond to that and think, yeah. well, I'll start off with, because to come out with colour would be a very bold statement, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I wouldn't have. Again, it was a gradual thing. I you're right. I know you. If you're reviewing exhibitions for magazines, you're going around galleries and looking at what's current, what's being exhibited, and what may or may not be being sold, and what people seem to be interested in at the time. And there probably was a certain amount of work that was, kind of colourful, but I didn't really notice it. But what I did notice was, I certainly thought, if I'm reviewing this and I don't think it's that good, one way of dealing with that is to write about it and to sort of try to explain to yourself or to anyone else that it isn't that good. The alternative would be to make better work yourself, and it always struck me as a better option to do the latter. I always felt more compelled to do that. It's a longer term response to what you're seeing, but
so having not actually published anything or put it in a gallery, what was the process like? You're thinking, right, I've got this, I'm going to do this work. You just go up to a gallery owner, and I literally don't understand the process. Like, I'm sure it's more complicated.
I don't think I do either. I mean, you start. You realize you can't go and approach a gallery unless you've got a body of work. I didn't have any work. The stuff I'd done at art school, in foundation courses, that had gone the way of everything. So I realized I was going to have to spend quite a lot of time developing a body of work, working out what I wanted to make and how I was going to make it, and finding a subject, finding a material to work. I didn't know whether I was going to be making paintings or sculptures or what. You just need time to work out what. I was always interested in abstract art somehow, but that was about it. And I began by making
such a personal thing for you as well, though, isn't it? Do you see it as your personality? This is exactly. Is it a clear expression?
No, it's not. It's an unclear expression, perhaps. So I'm not even sure it's that. I don't have any sense that it's my autobiography on the wall, except that in some respects it is, because no one else has done it. It's by you, and to some extent it's of you, but it's not necessarily about you. I suppose that's the thing, and I don't think the artist is needs to be present, as it were, in the work. The work is its own thing, and I think this whole idea about talking about when the work gets away from you, because in a way your fine ideas sort of crumble to dust. I think that's an important thing about the work. The work is its own thing. It's not just a some sort of reflection of you. It's beyond you in some important way. And so that, I think I've always thought that, and I certainly still think that, although, it is also me. I tried to build up a body of work, and I tried to get people to look at it, and almost no one would. It's very hard to get people to come and look at your work, especially if you're not, fresh out of college and have just done a degree show somewhere. And if you're not in London, which I, when I graduated, I clearly wasn't. And I don't think there was even back then any tradition of galleries, commercial galleries looking at degree shows, because there was no market again.
Because it's such a fair, you just saying it's so hard to get people to come and look at your work.
Yeah, really hard.
Well, I was really, when I first started the podcast, I was like, it's going to be great. People listen to it. And then I put the first one out, and 50 people listened to it, and
a lot more than came to my studio.
but then after the first day, it's just tailed off completely, and you're like, oh, but they kind of sell this social media idea that once you're online, millions of people look at it. But actually, it's incredibly hard to generate. So you had your work in a gallery? Were you?
No, I had my work in a studio, and I tried to get people from galleries, from commercial galleries, and from project spaces to come and look at it. And it was almost always excruciating and and really kind of abject and humiliating often, because you know, people generally, if they turned up, they probably weren't that interested. And you knew it. You know, and in the end, what you also probably knew, that the work wasn't good enough. Or, of course, my genius was misunderstood, but that, you know, I'm wary of that delusion, you know, that you could, I know, you know, it's quite possible to, you know, have a, to maintain that, you know, that the, you know, the rest of the world is out of step and they simply don't get your
They've
work.
They've just misunderstood it completely.
Yeah, and that's a dangerous place to go to, because you can actually then cultivate an idea that your work's, you know, only good because no one's going to look at it.
This sounds like, as my mum would describe it, character building. This is that's how she'd spin it.
But it was a slow, you know, uncomfortable process. And if there's a few people who'd come, you know, on a regular basis to look at my work and talk about it with me. And for those, and I really remain eternally grateful to those few people, still who are very good friends. And
really, even
In particular, there's a very good friend of mine, Bryony Furr, who's an art historian, works at UCL, and you know, she came to look at the work really early on. Charles Harrison, who previously taught me, now dead, he came in, and you know, they both would, and you know, one or two other people would come on a regular basis and talk about the work seriously, and that was, you know, hugely helpful.
There must be points in your career then that you look back on to think that, you know, that was one of the key moments, and those early kind of just someone to recognize and talk to and engage with your work must have, you know, it must mean the world at the time.
Yeah, it does. I was in a slightly odd position because I didn't really graduate with a bunch of other students. Mm. We all sort of scattered to the, you know, different corners, and there was no sense of a momentum once we finished art college at all, I think, to continue and stick to, you know, it just didn't work like that at the time. And I think more often than not, when groups of, you know, ex-students do sort of break into a, you know, a world outside college, they do it as a group and do it as a generation. You know, and the most obvious example is that so-called YBA. And, you know, that often is a way of coping and a way of keeping a conversation going and have people talk to you and talk to them. And that didn't work for me. It just wasn't, you know, that just didn't happen. Anyway, but, you know, slowly, you know, I got put in a couple of group shows, some of which were deeply embarrassing, really awful. And the gallery never spoke to me again. And, you know, and you fantasize that this is the big breakthrough, and it's not.
Yeah.
You know, and you reflect later on, you know, you kind of know that it's not.
You're like, it really was bad. Oh, it was bad.
It was really bad. And, you know, it's, and you've got no one really to make you go to the studio apart from yourself, you know. And if you didn't go to the studio, no one's going to notice.
Yeah.
So
just to build them, just to keep your own enthusiasm up, I guess, early on, if people, you know, you're putting yourself out there and it doesn't come back, does it affect your, do you change tact with your work, or do you carry on?
It's a hard one to call that. I mean, I remember the first work I ever sold, which still makes me happier than, you know, anything I've done since. And at the time, I was doing essentially I had in the studio three different types of work on the go. I wasn't even thinking of it like that, but that was effectively what. And this guy bought one of one type. And I immediately thought, okay, I'm just going to make that from now on.
Yeah.
But then I thought, well, yeah, he's just some kind of fairly random collector. What, I mean, who says that his judgment is... Yeah, right. And it's, you know, and you, on one hand, you want to be skeptical of that, but at the same time, it's impossible not to be drawn by that as well. Impossible.
Especially the first sale, you must have been like,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's check, you know. It's, you know, it's a complicated process, and it's psychologically very, you know, confusing at times, emotionally draining and confusing. But, you know, you either keep going or you don't. As simple as that.
I guess once you keep going after that, if you were to just have kept doing that same one, that must be such a hard trap not to fall within, especially if you do 20 different works, but the only two get recognised of a certain style. You're like, do I keep pushing?
Yeah, you do. And I mean, but you know, once you've been around a block a couple of times, and you know, I saw you know, artists, you know, sort of younger artists are coming through, and you know, one or two of them got quite very well known for a certain, very particular body of work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was shown a lot, and it was written about a lot, and it was, you know, everything you could, and it was sold a lot, you know, everything you could possibly desire.
Yeah.
But this particular type of work by this particular person didn't really have a kind of, it wasn't very organic in the way that it didn't evolve into something else. It was just like, in a sense, repeating the same thing. Now, at a certain point, you know, the collectors who collect it they're not going to carry on.
Mm.
And the galleries that are showing it, the collectors aren't buying it, aren't going to want to keep showing it. So I think this particular artist was strongly encouraged just to keep knocking them out, keep producing them. And then at a certain point, that market stopped. And the gallery turned around and said, "Well, you know, why aren't you doing anything else?"
Yeah.
So it's
because the gallery gets a cut of the sale, right? So they want to keep selling work. So they shot themselves in the foot, really.
Well, yeah, but then you know everyone has their their failings and I mean, it's easy to be wise in retrospect.
Do you look back at your earlier work and do you still see the things that you liked in at the time? With hindsight, are you like, what was I thinking? Or, I really like that. Both.
Really? Some stuff you look back and you think, actually, I wasn't so bad, was I? And other stuff you think, yeah, no, that was pretty awful. that was a mistake. I still think that now. You know, you never quite know.
Mm.
After a certain point, you can. You know, I recently there was the Centre of Contemporary Cultural Studies in Birmingham where I studied with Stuart Hall. Had its 50th anniversary, and I was interviewed a couple of times by researchers about that period, and I did make a group of drawings immediately I left there, which I'd never shown to anyone, and certainly had never tried to exhibit. They were very much me just trying to, you know, find some space for myself. And I showed this researcher these drawings, and they asked if they could exhibit them as part of this anniversary, 50th anniversary celebration. So I did, and because it's so distant now, and I'm, in a way, I don't really think about whether they're any good or not.
Mm.
They're just a fact of my past. And I think, you know, they're showing them not because they were great, but because of what I've done since, in a way. So, you know.
But those earlier works, they were still the monochromatic works, right? And then
they were pen and ink drawings, so they were black and white.
They were black and white. And then, because what made you get into colour?
Okay. This is where we should be getting to, yeah. I was trying to make a freestanding three-dimensional work for the first time. Everything else I made had been wall-based, constructions and paintings and drawings. And for reasons it was not worth going into, I wanted to make a freestanding 3D work, and it sort of wasn't going very well, not surprisingly. And one of the things I wanted to do was to make a work which had a radically different front from back, that it wouldn't be like sculpture in the round, like a Henry Moore, that it would be something much more like a billboard, and which to me at the time felt like it would be more like the city than like nature. You know, surfaces and fronts and backs, but not, you know, not in the round like a tree or a hill or something. And I couldn't get this thing to work. And I tried and I failed and I tried. And in a moment of desperation, I realized I probably needed to really emphasize the difference between the front and the back more than I had been doing. So I slapped essentially a bright pink on the front to differentiate it from the sort of raw timber, old timber of the back.
That'll do it.
and it kind of worked. And I've still got it. It's still in the studio, and I can see it now. And it's a tiny little work. It's only about 25 centimeters high. I'll show it to you in a bit. And you know, I made that, and it began to do what I was looking for, which was to articulate this sort of radical, more or less radical sort of difference between front and back, and so that, you know, from one side you couldn't tell what was happening on the other side, and it did it by using colour. Although, you know, I didn't use colour with colour in mind. I used colour with front and back in mind, if you see what I mean. But as this thing sort of sat around my studio, the colour became more visible, and I began to wonder why there wasn't much colour in contemporary art at the time, at least the stuff that I was noticing and I was aware of, and that just gradually worked on me. And it was just I had a series of questions like, you know, why is there so little color in art at the moment? What's wrong with color?
This was in the early 90s, or
this was in about 92. I can date it precisely. Yeah. So July 92. And I had been in an exhibition, and I'd shown some of this not very good earlier work at a gallery, and we went to the gallery owner's house, and the entire house was black and white and grey. There wasn't a smidgen of colour in this entire environment. So,
sounds like an architect's dream.
Yeah, well, and
not
it was,
mine.
No, exactly. And it was this 19th century building had been converted by a sort of architect come interior designer, so that all the walls and the floor and everything, and the ceiling, of course, was white. All the furniture was black leather, you know, corb stuff, and all the works of art were grey. Seriously, literally.
Just everything.
Grey painting. So, yeah, and you can, if it's a test you can do with an artist, is okay, you know, name the paintings. It's Alan Charlton, and it's Roman Opalka. You know, artists who made very good work but just happened to be grey. And that moment, that experience also fed into my sort of wondering about colour. And I kind of wanted to get my revenge on this gallery a bit as well.
This was which gallery is this?
I can't possibly tell you. Victoria Miro. when she had it was a long time ago, and she had a small gallery on Cork Street at the time, not the huge place she has now. And you know, so bit by bit, I just thought maybe colour's something, you know, no one's using it, maybe it gives me a bit of space to work.
Was your worry about using colour, though?
It was just that. I wasn't worried about
not
using
worried,
it,
but like
because no one was, so I didn't even think about it.
Because, to me, colour's quite a such a visual thing, and
it is entirely a visual thing.
Is it seen as simple using colour?
Like, okay. What is deemed to be wrong with colour? In the sort of, you know, higher echelons of, you know, the art world and theory and history and white, you know, so what I began to notice was you can go right back to Aristotle, the Greeks, and you can follow this through the academies of the 18th century and 19th century and notions of, you know, conceptual art and so forth, and you can see I was very quickly noticed a pattern of resistance to colour, and colour was generally deemed sort of other to the higher workings of the Western mind, and it was often represented as being feminine as opposed to masculine, as being primitive as opposed to civilised, as being oriental as opposed to occidental, as being infantile as opposed to adult. It was always positioned as somehow in the sort of negative part of a highly, you know, fabricated opposition. Or colour was often represented as being cosmetic rather than somehow real. So, you know, cosmetics can seduce or deceive or can mask the truth of something, you know, which also codes colour as feminine or maybe as camp. So there was this big weight of Western sort of philosophical and historical resistance to colour.
It's just amazing. There's just so much thought and history behind the use of colour.
And a lot of this stuff came from art as well. It was an artistic resistance to colour. And I termed this resistance to colour chromophobia, the fear of colour. And the more I read about this, the more I noticed these patterns, the more I thought, well, sort of, you know, there's something to do. There really is something to do here.
Yeah.
And I'm really going to bend the stick and try to, you know, sort of chuck as much colour back in to the world that had been excluded from it. Not least to try to mess up that, you know, sort of rather kind of anal environment of in the collectors I described. And it was, in a way, it was quite a kind of crude response to begin with. And
this was the first piece of work that you actually put in a gallery that explored the front and the back.
The first piece of work I put in a gallery that explored the front and the back was a white and construction, and that's one of the reasons it didn't work. But it was quite a long time between making my first piece of work in colour and exhibiting any colour-based work.
Was that purely because you wanted to experiment enough to in your own space until you were confident enough to or you didn't want to do a knee-jerk reaction and you wanted to develop it?
And I wasn't getting any offers. You know, that too.
Yeah.
I mean...
because the market... There's no market for it,
It's not
right?
even the market. I mean, it is the market. You're right. But it's also the in a way, the culture wasn't new. Mm. There's lots of the art world isn't in the market. There's independent curators, there's museum and Kunsthalle curators and critics and people aren't in it for the money necessarily. Mm. And writers have won. It just felt that no one was discussing this stuff at the time. So inevitably it took a while to convince anyone that it might be worth showing.
So your first struggle was just to get anyone to be interested in the colour that you were using.
I was both making work in the studio. As a result of making that work, I was also reading around colour for the first time and beginning to notice these patterns of resistance to colour. So I began publishing stuff about it, and it was some respects easier to publish.
So you actually published Chromophobia before
doing your works? No. I published a couple of short essays on colour, really short ones. One called Colour and the Monochrome for a catalogue, and one an essay for an exhibition in Leeds. So,
and how were they received in the art world then?
I don't know. I mean, you don't really. It's like the podcast. You write it, and then it just sort of falls into a pit. Somewhat later, people can come up and say, "Oh, I read that." Maybe people come up and say, "I read that, and it was quite useful," and so on. Mm. But these were small scale, tentative, attempts to sort of put out there some of what I was thinking about and working on in the studio. So that happened. I began to exhibit the studio work. The first one-person exhibition I did was in Leeds in the Henry Moore Institute, and they asked me to write a short text to go with these colour-based, small, very small colour-based works.
And that's when ones on palette.
No, it was before that. I hide these ones now. I don't know. No one really sees them. They weren't very good.
They were misunderstood.
No, they weren't very good. They were understood. That's the problem. It was the works I made, the dollies with panels of colour, and I made in 1996. So that's, and they were probably the first works that in a way had any public sort of response. Mm. And so that was a good 4 years after I'd begun working with colour. And in 2000, I published Chromophobia. So again, it's a relatively slow process. And the beginning to exhibit that work in 96, 97 and publishing the book in 2000 were probably the two most important sort of stepping stones, I guess, for me.
Was the earlier work illuminated?
No.
Or was that later?
The illuminated work came along when I'd been working, making things in colour. I realised that the colours I was interested in were urban colours, and the subject and the shapes and the forms, it's about the city. Like I said about the front and back thing, it's about the city. Yeah. So in a way, the city was a kind of general subject, abstract subject for the work. And I wanted to make works which were about the city, but in a completely abstract way, not in any sense illustrative. So they would be made of the city, found materials and the kind of, the typical materials of the city, steel and...
Because I was listening to your talk on my cycle home at night, and it was only when you said it and I started looking around, you realize everything's illuminated. Every shop window, there's acrylic-based signs with like basic lights behind, and it's not until someone suggests it, you're like, oh yeah, it's everywhere. Everything you see is a function of some sort of...
Exactly. And where was I? So I thought, okay, well, if that's my subject... It's the city and the kind of colours that are typical of the city. Mm. Then I've got to look at the main ways in which colour is delivered in the city. And of course, one of the ways is through illumination. Light boxes, fluorescence, and plexiglass. Neon, and then there's a lot of it around. Mm. And I thought, well, I I had a decision, yeah, I've got to go and get some more light boxes and try working with illuminated colour now, because that's a very prominent form of...
Well, it's funny, they'd be quite expensive to make if you had to produce a light box yourself, but actually the, the recycled element of using it works in twofold, really, doesn't it? It's,
The pleasure of working in East London is there are all these salvage places where you know, they get old, you know, they strip out old, you know, offices and restaurants and buildings, and then they, you know, they sell the stuff on, and you could always get... I knew a lot of artists who were going around these same places as me, but we all looked for different stuff. And I was looking for the light boxes and old dollies and such like. And you could always come up with it, luckily, because I couldn't, you know, otherwise you say it'd be very expensive to have these things made.
And then, because I was also thinking that, you know, your earlier works that weren't illuminated and the monochrome stuff, they're in a static gallery, they're on a wall. But the second you introduce light, do you then start controlling the atmosphere of the gallery? I mean, you want it not as dark as possible, but I guess you can curate the experience a little bit more. It becomes more theatrical, doesn't it? If you can dim the lights, your work is more proud.
Yeah, you have to. I have to be. I'm quite careful about that. I don't like completely darkened spaces for art. I don't like them much anyway, and I don't like walking into a very dark, and you know, in a gallery and going through a dark corridor and then being faced by this sort of magical thing on the wall. But you're right. If you do illuminated work, then if you drop the light levels, it becomes more. It's more vivid. That's a problem if you're putting illuminated work in with other types of work that require good lighting. So, and with the solid coloured works, the dollies and all the paintings, you know, you need it as vivid as you know good ambient lighting as possible, so you need high light levels for that. So you have to sort of trade off a bit. You can sort of more theatrically kind of control the gallery environment. I'm a bit wary of that, though.
Because I remember back when I was doing my part one, we had to go to the Hayward Gallery to go look at Dan Flavin.
Flavin.
And I didn't really understand it, and I didn't know what I was going into, and we were told to go, and I went in, and you know, it was a very dark room, all with like lurid green, and the whole room was only lit by this, and I just sat down in the corner for like half an hour doing some sketches, and just
why on earth would you sketch a Dan Flavin? Why would you sketch a fluorescent light bulb?
I had to do a project on it, and you're right. It does sound ridiculous when you say it like that, but it made more sense when I was doing it.
Yeah.
But it was really interesting. And since then, I guess that was the catalyst, because every room had a slightly different type of colour in, and different colours really affected the kind of mood of the room and the kind of the more moodier colours, the reds and the greens. People were quieter in those rooms, and then they're much brighter. But then I was about to say happy colours. That simplifies it, I think, in a way that I don't think. Do you agree that, like, is it as simple as, well, bright colours make people happy, dark colours?
Well, I mean, I think at a certain level, it's probably true. But I don't think you can work with that particularly. You know, it's.
I don't mean to oversimplify it. I was trying to explain it in my own head, and I was like,
I mean, for me, Dan Flavin is obviously a really, you know, important reference point. Mm. And you know, he only worked with, you know, standard shop bought fluorescent lamps and their holders, and he never hid the holders, and he never tarted it up, and you could always see the flex and the plugs. Mm. And that was always very important to me, that sort of directness and straightforwardness of, yeah, it is what it is, but it also generates these extraordinary, you know, luminous effects at the same time. And I love that relationship between the very everydayness of the materials and the quite extraordinary, you know, effects of coloured light.
Yeah, definitely.
So yeah, when you're using, I mean, there are only about half a dozen colours that Flavin could work with, because they were the only colours that were produced in fluorescent lights at the time. And the problem with his work now is that those tubes are no longer made. So you kind of, if when the tubes go, you can't replace them.
Gives it an even bigger temporary feel. I guess it's harder to sell his works if they're,
you know, one of the reasons if you're working with, you know, illuminated stuff, plexiglass and fluorescent lights and LEDs even, you've got a pretty restricted palette. You've got some brilliantly vivid colours, but it's pretty restricted. You know, it was quite hard. I needed 15 colours of plexiglass, which I could backlight, And it was very hard to find 15 from different suppliers and that would all work with one another. One of the reasons I've been enjoying making paintings for the first time since foundation course, so that's a long time.
Are these the paintings in the background?
Yeah, these I call them colour chart paintings. They're very simple. I mean, I've got to talk about them in more detail, but they allow me to use a lot wider range of colour than I otherwise have done. So I've found myself using, well, black and white as well as more vivid reds or yellows, but also I'm found myself using greys and some soft, quite pastel colours, but also some very dark maroons and blues. And it's really been great to be able to expand the range of colours, and illuminated work doesn't offer you that possibility.
Yeah, I mean, as on chromo, not chromo rotation.
Chromorama, we think.
Chromorama. And a huge part of it is you trying to work out this is the quality of light I want to get. And there's only certain manufacturing methods that, well, one, will last outside and not degrade in light, and two, that look okay with LED backing or soft light backing. And actually the technical side of it, when they get to this size, because the chromorama is going to be, what, 20 metres high?
The work is 20 metres high and it sits on a 2.5 metre base. So, it's going to be big.
Yeah.
But it has a very narrow footprint. It's only the plinth on which it sits is a metre square. So it's very tall and very thin. It's got a pencil thin, I hope.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to look amazing.
It's going to be 35 double-ended light boxes sat on top of it. Well, appearing, effectively sat on top of one another, all facing in different directions. So it'll look quite jumbled in a way, but actually each box sits at exactly the same angle off the box below it.
And the nice thing is with Broadgate in the background, that stainless steel, it's surrounded on two sides by quite a reflective material. So
yes.
I imagine at night, we've actually taken the lights off on those risers on the outside.
Yeah.
So your chromorama is the only thing lighting that side.
No, and there's a tree in front of it too, which will absorb some of the light as well, which would be quite interesting. And yeah, that'd be different in the summer from winter. So yeah, as ever with these, this is, I don't do many external sort of public projects of this kind. And this one in Broadgate is, I think it's the second outdoor piece I've done ever, in London.
Which one's your other one?
I'm not telling you. I don't like the other one.
Sweep that under the rug.
But you always have to work in a different kind of manner. It's not something I can make in the studio, obviously, so I'm working fabricators. But these are fabricators I've worked with on many occasions, and they know how I like to work. And then, of course, you're dealing with engineers, architects, clients,
bloody architects,
developers. Yeah. It's a different ball game.
Do you, because these are really, they're hugely public works. I mean, this and Chroma Locomotion in St. Pancras.
Yes.
They're no longer in the gallery environment. They're in the outside world where people have no idea of why it's up there.
Yeah.
And is that more exciting knowing that people are going to see it afresh?
I don't know. I have mixed feelings about that. In some respects, I don't. If I had a choice, everything I make would be temporary.
Mm.
So the St. Pancras piece, which was suspended above the Eurostar line, it was 20 metres wide and 10 metres high, and it was
huge.
Very big. It didn't look so big because it's in a vast train shed. The arc of the train shed, the span of the arch is 100 metres, more or less. So it's a huge thing.
Such an amazing train station, isn't it?
But I like the fact that it was up for 6 months. Because, once something's been up for a while, it becomes invisible.
Mm.
You get habituated to everything in the end.
Yeah, it's true.
And, I mean, having said that, this chromorama is going to be on a longer term. And I'm hesitant about that, imposing things on a public.
Because some people see it going, there'll be a knee-jerk reaction to just not liking it. And they've got no idea about the background of it or anything.
Well, that's, you have to deliver something. You can't expect them to go and read a book about it. That's not their job. And all you can do is place it there and say, be available if you like to, to explain it in some form or another. But
if you had your ideal project, is it quite in the public realm, or do you prefer kind of the more controlled environment of a gallery?
If I did something, for example, the St. Pancras project, I really enjoyed doing that because it was a real challenge, because the that train shed, you know, that 1868 steel and iron and glass structure, which was the biggest freestanding arch in the world at the time. It's the most beautiful bit of industrial architecture,
stunning, isn't it?
You know, of that heroic period, if you, you know, and that, you know, to do something within that environment is really difficult because it's visually incredibly rich in and of itself. And to make something which is simply going to be visible there is hard enough. And to make something which you think has a relationship with it, both of somehow connected but also standing apart from it, you know, it requires quite a lot of thinking and quite a lot of trial and error practice. And you know, that takes you places where you don't normally go, and that's generally a good thing, I think.
So the work of art was a total reaction. Did you go there, spend a day in there, kind of get a whole day?
No, I spent ages there. I took photographs of every bit of the architecture and tried to find elements within, you know, kind of small elements within the way the building is fabricated I could sort of work off to generate, you know, my thing. And it went through very many different versions. And what I came up with in the end was probably slightly remote from what I began with, you know, as is the way of these things. It works with verticals and horizontals, and there's a lot of them, and it works with steel and glass. So the materials are related. But also, obviously, I'm using transparent color like stained glass windows, so the color does a lot of the separation job that
You had the sun kind of... Yeah. Beaming through at points through this thing. I mean, what a scale to work at, though, to have such an enormous piece in an even bigger area with the sun shining through.
That was great. You know, I'm really, you know, delighted I got to do that. Mm. And you learn from it. And you know, I've subsequently been making more works using, you know, as it were, you know, transparent coloured plexiglass. And shining light through them all in order that they create a reflection and making the reflection the work. So, I mean, the reflections are always a part of any coloured work, particularly illuminated, whether it's self-illuminated or illuminated by a spotlight or by the sun. And in a way, reflections to me are almost the best bit. They're the most ephemeral. They're the kind of colour unbounded, uncontained by a box or by a, you know, shape or by a form or a bit of steel.
It sounds the incidental part again as well. That would have been the nice incidental part of seeing your work maybe on a rainy day in a puddle or that kind of...
No, exactly that. And that's the pleasure for me, is that those moments that you can't predict or anticipate that and that are entirely determined by the quality of light at the time, your position... and you know, the time of day, and it's gone.
So do you find that once you finished that set of work, it got such a great reaction? Were people like, "Could you do another one of those for us, or can we have that? Can you just pedal it out again? That'd be great."
Yeah, not to some extent. People say, "Oh yeah, we'd love to reinstall it." I said, "Okay, you know how much it weighs, you know how much it would cost to get the trucks to do it, you know how much." And it stacks up, and suddenly it becomes a lot less attractive as an option. You know, and it is essentially, it's simply expensive to hang a, you know, 4-ton 20
where
meter
are the
wide.
Pieces? They're not in here, are they?
Some of them are.
Are they?
Oh no. The fabricator Setworks who made that work, and it's made in all these, the various L shapes it's made from all break down into single L shapes, each of which is 3.5 meters high. They're all on pallets back at Setworks.
They're at Setworks
workshop in Croydon. But
can you make a kitchen worktop out of it?
Can you
make a roof out of it?
I know that it's never going to be shown again. There's not... Anyway, it was made specifically for that environment. And so I shouldn't expect it to find another space. If there's going to be another one, it would be different. And it should be different. So actually, in my new studio, tables are made out of the St. Pancras. And I'm thinking of sort of equipping the entire studio with the remnants of St. Pancras.
It'd be such a nice full cycle, wouldn't it, to get all of it back in here?
Yeah, it would. I mean, maybe not all of it, because there's quite a lot. but it's it makes me strangely happy to see it, to work with it as an entirely different thing now.
So So I've just realised we're already at the hour mark now.
I've got to move on
really quickly. So we'll wrap this up now. So what's next for you then? What are you working on now? And is there any more exhibitions coming up?
Or? Well, I've just come back from Sydney, where I was in the light show, which was at the Hayward Gallery, and that was always really interesting.
That was why you're out there for a month.
Yeah. Okay. I did an exhibition at the Whitechapel Gallery of a sequence of 500 photographs that I've been working on for about 18 years as a series of projections. That took a lot of doing, and again, it was something I've been building up to for a long time. Mm. I guess I've had quite a lot of works, made work for exhibition a lot up until quite recently. I've now got time actually to work in my new studio and develop some new work. Mm. You always require time to make new stuff and to make new mistakes. And so I'm just working on I'm getting back to working on the paintings, because I haven't had my old studio I lost 5 months ago, so I haven't really had a studio for a few months. I really need studio time. I need studio time.
Mm. Yeah.
That's the simple way of putting it. But I've got I'm in an exhibition which opens tomorrow, in fact, at Gagosian in London, which is called Sprayed. And it's a really nice, in a way, dumb, curatorial idea. And I mean that in the best possible way. All the work in the show is made with spray paint, with aerosol cans. And it starts mainly in the 1950s, David Smith, American sculptor. And it is just works by artists from all over who've used industrial spray paints in the work, and they're showing a few of my drawings, not unlike the ones immediately behind me at the moment. And I've used spray paints a lot, again, because they have that sort of urban quality, but also they're a way of delivering colour without boundaries, in a way. Colour which is not contained by an edge.
Mm.
It's sort of colour as a kind of atmosphere. And spray paint's a kind of very unique way of using colour. It's not like any other way. It's not like using a brush. It's not like pouring paint, isn't it? So, and this is going to be a really nice exhibition, because it's got a Warhol piss painting in it, because that's a kind of spray painting. It's nearly all the work is kind of abstract, which is interesting, because the other use of spray paint, obviously, is in street art, which is nearly always sort of illustrative and figurative.
How long is that on for?
The show opens on the Thursday, the 11th of, June, and it's on until the beginning of August.
Ah, perfect, because this podcast will be going out next Wednesday, so okay. I just wanted to... All right, that was really good. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for coming.
Well, I really hope you enjoyed that. That was episode number 2 of the Create More podcast with David Batchelor. I had such a fun time going over there. I use this podcast as a way in to just go and interview and talk to people I'm genuinely really, really interested in. So I use the podcast as a massive way just to do things that interest me. So the great thing is I got the opportunity to go to his new studio and going to Assemble Studios a couple of weeks ago as well. It's such an interesting thing. I've been at Make for so long, they've got such a lovely studio, but it's so nice to see how other people work. And David Batchelor's studio, as I said, like the ultimate man cave. If there's like, I think it's every architect's aspiration to have one of these studio spaces. It's like 25 meters long. It's these wonderful roof lights, and it's just everything in there is pristine and lovely. I know it's new. I'm sure I get a bit messier, but I just had that feeling that that is a really, really nice space to be in. And he had all his artwork everywhere, and it was so cool just being able to, just kind of like a little bit of a celebrity to me. So it's kind of cool just to go and ask him questions like that I would never get the chance to do normally. But with a microphone and a cheeky smile and a laptop, apparently I can just sit him down and talk to him for an hour. It was really, really good fun. So that's Assemble Studios. That's David Batchelor. And obviously, I'm going to tell you who I'm going to do next week. And I've already recorded it, but it'll be released 2 weeks tomorrow. So that'll be 2 weeks from Wednesday. And it's with Studio Weave, who are another kind of, I say small scale, but they're doing some really, really cool stuff. Another architecture studio who, again, for me, kind of straddle the realms of kind of art installations and architecture, the type of stuff that whenever I see it, I'm like, damn, that looks really cool. Wish I was involved in that. So yeah, I was talking to Jay from Studio Weave, and really, really, really cool guy, and so chilled out, and just rocked up in flip-flops when I saw him, and I met him before work, and yeah, we talked about loads of stuff. So that's in 2 weeks, so I really hope you've enjoyed this, and I'm really getting into the swing of things now, so I will speak to you in a couple of weeks, I guess. So bye-bye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.